Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
It is your Richie Allen Show. Thanks for tuning into it. Good to be with you. Tweet the program at any time between now and the end of it. It's at Richie Allen Show. That's the Twitter handle. Lots of tweets already. You're all sweltering. It's a sweltering evening here in the great city, and it's sweltering right across the country. And that weather, by the way, is going to last for the next couple of weeks and beyond. And you might remember months ago, before anybody else was predicting this weather, the terrific Piers Corbyn, who has been on this programme several times, the meteorologist, of course, with the famous brother, Piers predicted it. He said, we are going to have a very, very warm summer, June, July and into August. So we're going to have to think about that. Richie Allen Show listeners, we're going to have to think about it and think about it hard, because it is absolutely sweltering here. But thus far, 25 minutes in, we're not doing too bad. My first guest needs no introduction to you. Terrific journalist, spent many years at the BBC, of course. An authority on Bilderberg. Check out bilderberg.org, but many more things besides as well. His work on the 7/7 bombings back in 2005 alerted me to his presence. He presents the politics show on BCFM, which is a magnificent show on Fridays. We'll tell you more about that if you haven't heard of it a bit later on. Lots of things we want to get into with Tony, so let's not waste too much more time. Tony Gosling, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Richie. And what we try and do in Bristol every Friday is to do the city justice. I always felt this as a journalist, is that you should be doing the people that you listen to and the people that you represent, because we do as journalists have to, we're the eyes and ears of, you know, sometimes thousands, possibly even millions of people when you're on one of these massive networks like the BBC or RT. And my feeling is so much of modern journalism doesn't do justice to the people that it's supposed to represent. And so that's what we try and do every Friday.
It's brilliant. It's a great programme, Tony. I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. And you're absolutely right. It challenges local and national authorities and asking questions on behalf of people that are not being asked, sadly, anymore in the media. Tony, before you...
Yeah, well, we've been blacklisted by our mayor in Bristol. I mean, he's just blocked me on Twitter, for etc. He just simply will not talk. I mean, even when we had an independent mayor, George Ferguson, who's the former president of the Royal Institute for British Architects, became mayor a few years ago in Bristol, and he was quite prepared to come and face the music and answer for the £350 million of our money he was spending every year. Our present mayor, who's Labour, he's Marvin Rees is his name, he just will not come on. He simply will not. And actually, it's quite difficult to get, quite a lot of his cabinet won't either. So we're in a situation where the politicians actually lulled into this false sense of security by the mass media. They'll go and chat with the BBC, etc., but they won't ask and they won't face any of the difficult questions. So as the mass media has got worse over the last 30 years or so, and we can all see the way that's happened, what with the appalling coverage of the terrorist attacks in Britain and 9/11 and things like that. So the treacherous politicians have taken advantage of that. They see it as a safe place to go, where they won't get asked any difficult questions.
Yeah, it's an outrage that an important local station like BCFM, that they wouldn't talk to you. I want to ask you this. There's a couple of big things we're going to get into. We are going to talk about the future of the internet and European Union legislation. We'll talk about that in a minute. You've done some fascinating research into what happened in this city on May 22nd last year. I'm really keen to hear about that. But before that, I can't not ask you, what do you make of the UK government's decision to buy the Skripal's house and all of their possessions, and also to buy a home owned by Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey and all of his possessions as well? Tony, I've covered crimes, you know, on the crime beat for many years when I started out back home, and here, I never heard of anything like that. What's going on?
Well, first of all, totally unprecedented. Yeah. First I've heard of it, Richie. And, this is an attempt to purchase the evidence, isn't it? I mean, this is what this is really about. You know, the evidence, if it was allowed to float around and go, for example, to the people who really should be in charge of it, that is to say friends, relatives, that kind of thing, then there'll be all sorts of potential problems in the truth getting out about things like whereabouts this actual nerve agent was. I think, you know, this is unbelievable, really, that something like that should happen. And it does show that there's a hidden, I mean, partly I think the problem here is that we've got no real scrutiny of any of our military intelligence, that is MI5, MI6, GCHQ and the rest. There's nothing. There's supposed to be something called the Intelligence and Security Committee. But when this recent government was formed last year, it didn't even start meeting for months and months. So these guys know at MI5 and MI6 that they can just carry on regardless. They don't have to have anybody asking any questions. And when there's a terror attack, if they're implicated, as they were in Manchester and other places, there won't be any questions for months and months about what they're, you know, for example, an individual's intelligence officer's role. You know, maybe someone who was the person who was in charge of taking the information warning that Salman Abedi was a potential terrorist on the anti-terror hotline and then doing apparently nothing whatsoever about it. The disappearance of the big blue suitcase of Salman Abedi, no explanation whatsoever. Is there no explanation? So these people know that there won't be any scrutiny, rather like the arrogant politicians we've got of nowadays, just don't get asked any questions by the British press, the media, or by the politicians.
They certainly do not. Now, you've got some fascinating information about what happened here on May 22nd last year, which, you know, I don't do melodrama, and I've been very critical of the coverage of these things and how, you know, all of these remembrance minutes, silence and people gathering and how that's milked by the establishment and by the media. But however, I know it's upset people here, not just the people involved in it, but it shakes people up. These things shake people up. I think they're designed to shake people up, whoever's responsible for them. You've been in touch with a very interesting woman who was there on the night, Tony.
That's right. And these sorts of inquiries that we have nowadays. I was just listening to the news, the 6 o'clock news tonight on Radio 4 on the way to come and chat with you, Richie. And the first one of the first things they said is, well, the Grenfell inquiry is not a court of law. Well, I would say, why not? Why haven't we got a court of law? In fact, a public inquiry, it should be a court of law where the, you know, witnesses, etc., are compelled to come, possibly arrested and then brought to the court if they haven't come. And when a verdict is set down after that, whether it's a sort of inquest type verdict, like unlawful killing, accidental death, whatever, that that is the beginning of a process of people going to jail, quite possibly. But it doesn't seem like that's what they like to do with inquiries nowadays. And, of course, the same sort of thing happened with the Manchester attack, with the inquiry into that. I just think one of the things I looked at, first of all, I mean, what I wanted to say was that I was in touch directly with Dawn Waddy, who did an interview the day after the attack with Sky News, where she talked about seeing a suspicious woman who was playing with her bag next to her. She reported them twice to the private security, I think they're called ShowSec, private security at the Manchester Arena before the bomb went off. And then this woman also was looking at the place where the bomb went off. She was clearly not interested in the concert. She talks about her being foreign. She had some sort of accent when she spoke to her. I'm not sure if she even managed to speak English. We're not sure about that, although she's told Greater Manchester Police. But she also told me that she was extremely nervous about the whole process because the police had been to see her but had told her absolutely nothing whatsoever. Now, I don't know if there is such a thing as victim support in Manchester, but they should have gone back to Dawn and said, thank you very much for that useful information, or at least something. But she's had absolutely not a single word of them since. And she's getting very nervous, as is her daughter, who also appeared on that Sky TV clip, Richie. So what she's saying is potentially explosive. She's giving the testimony witness statement that there's possibly somebody else involved, not just this guy Salman Abedi, if he was to, and I personally think it looks more and more like he was some kind of patsy, that she could be an absolutely key witness. So rather than helping her and protecting her, it sounds to me like the Greater Manchester Police are piling pressure on her by their silence and by their lack of victim support, and simply not investigating the lines of inquiry that she has thrown up.
Yeah, because I looked at the clip today after you mentioned that you were going to bring it up. And this is, I've tweeted a link to it there now. She's very much, is Dawn Moddy, very much in control of herself and what she's saying, and is very definite and is very credible in terms of the report that she makes about this woman that she talked about. To not be contacted later on by the police to say, not to repeat what you said, Tony, but to say, well, look, we did look into this, or we did look into that, and we found this, or we didn't find that, is worrying. And I suppose I'm not surprised, Tony, that, you know, she feels very uneasy about that.
The other thing is, of course, this kind of eyewitness report echoes things like the Las Vegas machine gun killings. Compare it with that. We also had a very similar sort of report, which was given to live TV at the scene, which didn't fit with the official narrative at all at Las Vegas. We had a woman saying that there was someone going around in the crowd saying that there was going to be some kind of massacre. No one really took them seriously. So that whoever it was playing with people's hair and touching them. People felt that they had to move away from them. And this kind of arrogance, it seems to me, I mean, maybe these eyewitnesses are talking total rubbish, but I think if you go and have a look at Dawn's clip, she looks to me very much like someone who is imparting some crucial information that the police are not then afterwards taking any notice of, because it doesn't fit with the official MI5 version of events. You know, we always get these narratives. This is what happened. The other thing about, I'd like to just run through some of the things in Manchester, which particularly bother me. First of all, the helpline, which was totally ineffective. Vodafone are contracted by the Home Office. God knows why it's Vodafone. But, they're, you know, an appalling company anyway, in many ways. But they are supposedly were there to set up a helpline as soon as the attack had happened, as soon as they was asked to. But they said, oh, very sorry. And for many hours, they just failed to do it. They couldn't do it. So there was no helpline. And when people were phoning to get information about loved ones that might have been killed, there was nothing. There's basically just a ringing out and dial tone number unobtainable. And so Vodafone completely failed. This is similar, actually, to what happened in the 7/7 London bombings, when the relatives for nearly a week after those bombings were just not given any information by the police whatsoever. It was basically just a wall of silence. The authorities, even though they, you know, presumably had some information about who'd been killed, bodies, identification, that sort of thing, were giving absolutely nothing away. Now, that sort of thing, it allows kind of cover up to be going on in the process. So, you know, who knows what might be going on. They should be telling people if they know that they've got your loved one's body. They should not be forcing people to wait and wait and wait. So that was one of the first things that struck me about Manchester. Then there were the false alarms, exactly the same as took place at the Westminster attack of a second terrorist on the loose at Manchester, which apparently caused the fire service to wait on standby for 2 hours. Now, those firemen could have been in there, first of all, as witnesses to potential attackers who were running away, and also, more importantly, as first aiders to help people with oxygen and to help people stay alive. But no, they were told to go away. They weren't allowed to go anywhere near the scene.
Extraordinary.
The Northern Rail workers also, who, because the bomb took place that blew up on the entrance, the railway entrance,
Victoria Station, yeah,
to the arena. They were also told by the police to go away. Now, that they were told by the police to go away whilst they were actually aiding people to stay alive. They all to a man, apparently, all of them, every single person, refused to go when they were told to by the police. So they said, no, we're going to stay here and help these dying people, thank you very much. So these sorts of behaviours by the police, I think, are just totally inexcusable. So, you know, we also see eyewitnesses like Dawn. Okay, she was interviewed, but, you know, what's happened with that information? Nothing. She's not been called back. She's not been you know, many people in these terror attacks are not even interviewed. You find journalists go, like you and I might go along afterwards, Richie, and find, well, people say, well, no police have spoken to me. There doesn't seem to be the sort of level of proper investigation taking place. And you know what? This strikes me as something much more scripted. Just as I found at 7-7, it seemed like it was scripted rather than that the police were doing a proper investigation. It seemed like they'd already decided who'd done it before the investigation had even started.
This is good stuff, Tone. Let me just jump in. This is good stuff because some people would listen to this and they would listen to you and they would say, right, okay, Tony, he's asking some good questions. However well trained these first responders are in a chaotic scene, maybe they can make mistakes. However, what negates that, because that's the devil's advocate position, which I would have put to you over the years. Look, Tony, there's a bomb gone off, it's chaos, mistakes are made. However, that point of view is negated, is made redundant by the fact that it carries on, that behaviour carries on in the weeks and months after the attack. Like you said there, why hasn't anybody assured Dawn Waddy that we have found this woman whom you speak of? We have spoken to her and we've eliminated her from her inquiries. Why hasn't anybody followed that up?
That's a what she said to me was that she gave them the seat number, for example, so they could presumably have traced her. But no, they haven't apparently done anything, and they haven't certainly been back to her a year after that. You know, as a key eyewitness, they should have done. But look, what about this whole business of private security? Shosek, who were doing the private security at the Manchester Arena. Now, I wonder, who are these people? There were complaints on the Manchester Arena website on TripAdvisor saying, these people, who are they? Because their security is zero. They're not checking anything. They're not checking us. They're not checking bags. They're just standing around. One does wonder, what is the point of employing a private security firm or any kind of security firm that doesn't actually check anything as people go in and out? Are they just looking as someone looks suspicious? Maybe they've got a patch over their eye. They might stop them and say, are you a terrorist? Yeah. You know, this is not security. This is a bit like in the run-up, as I'm sure you remember, to the 2012 Olympics, Richie, when what was his name? Ben Fellows gave a really interesting report of all of the nonsense that G4S were doing, pretending to do security. Now, that's just simply not good enough at a massive event like the Olympics. And the thing is that these private terror companies, we now know through things like ISTS, I think their name is, the company, the Israeli-based company that was doing the security at airports for the 9/11 attack, that these are potentially terror vectors. ICTS, incidentally, let the shoe bomber on the plane with no passport. So these private security companies, I think, number one, we've just got to get rid of them. No private security, thank you very much. We'll just have ordinary, normal police and no private security, because it doesn't seem to me as if they were doing anything at Manchester Arena, Richie, at all.
Tell me this, Tony, tell me this. Tell me this, because you, obviously, this is your country, and I'm, you know, I've been here a few years now, I've lived here before, I have lived here a couple of times over the years, but you and I are of a similar age. What were concerts like, Tony, 25, 30 years ago? Would they have been policed by the police, or would there have been event security hired in? Because I'm very interested in that. When did venues start hiring them in?
When I was a teenager and going to concerts at the Hammersmith Odeon, yes, there would be a few police around and a few private security. They probably wouldn't have actually been physically searching people, but they would have been there to get rid of anybody that was causing a disruption. And if Dawn
and first
goes up to one of these security people today and says to them, look, this person is acting suspiciously, will you please make sure that they're not up to anything? And she says it twice, and her daughter is involved in this too. And what she says, she said to me was that the woman, what she got from the private security, they said to her, how would you like it if someone accused you just because you were a different colour? Now, that's incredibly suspicious that they should say something like that, because, I mean, we know and everybody knows that the potential is that somebody of a different colour might potentially be a terrorist, just as somebody white might be a terrorist. So what they're doing is they're just trying to dismiss legitimate claims of someone who is suspicious about somebody. And for somebody to have actually raised this, it's very unlikely that would normally happen at a concert.
Very unlikely.
But for someone to have raised it beforehand, and then there was one of the most horrendous terrorist attacks, killing 22 people in British history, happening after that was raised, and then for her to hear absolutely nothing back whatsoever from the police, I find totally unbelievable. And I think that the police should go around today, tonight, tomorrow, to see Dawn, to reassure her that we will protect you and we will make sure that you're looked after, Dawn, rather than taking a statement and never speaking to you again.
And ignoring her. And just to remind our listeners, some of whom might be joining us late, Tony is talking about a lady who gave a statement to event security while the event was going on. She later told the police this, and she told it to the national media as well, that there was a woman sitting next to her, constantly smirking to herself, constantly looking in the direction of where the blast would later come from. This woman disappeared a few minutes before the end of the concert, just before the bomb went off. This is obviously somebody whom you'd want to speak to if you were one of the investigating team looking into this. It's very serious, Tony. It's good stuff. I look forward to, I know you've been in touch with her, and I know you wanted to get an in-depth conversation with her, but she's a bit spooked. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, no, she has been completely spooked. Goodness knows exactly why, but she won't. I don't think she'll be contacting me again. She told me this stuff, and then all of a sudden just cut me off. So, anyway, I had a bit of soul searching as to whether to share this with you, but you know, she was, I think, being totally open and honest with me until she got very frightened. And of course, this is exactly what happens, is people who are saying something which the real perpetrators, whoever they were, don't like, the frighteners are put on them, and the police should be protecting her, not allowing that to happen. Look, also, I mean, another thing which happens in all these terror attacks, it seems, and we've got to start looking out for these in every single attack that happens in the future, I'm afraid, you know, it's likely that there will be more, that there was a whole spate in the run-up to the general election, wasn't there, of course, last year, but then they do seem to happen during elections for some strange reason and then stop. So the other thing is that the terror suspect, Salman Abedi, was incredibly well-known to MI5. He'd also been reported on the anti-terror hotline. You know, this is exactly the same as happened with the London Bridge attack. It's exactly the same that happened with the Westminster attack. And finally, I suppose, is that the real problem is you've got a totally unaccountable MI5, no accountability whatsoever. So this is what they call the permanent government. These are the people that never change. Whoever you vote for, they're always the same people. Nosy Parker is the guy's name. Andrew Parker, the Director General of MI5. He's the guy who is in charge of the public spinning, that is to say PR, and the narrative of the 7/7 London bombings, which didn't make any sense. It was completely flawed. But that didn't seem to matter because no one was asking too many questions, apart from, by the way, the families of the people that died on 7/7, some of whom I've been in touch with, and who are absolutely livid about the fact that MI5 have not paid the price after all the mistakes they've made over the years. And so his role, I think, is really important. Also, of course, as I'm sure you'll know, Richie, is MI5's role in Northern Ireland. Extremely suspect. MI5 seems to me to be literally a kind of Crowley-esque law unto itself. It's an organisation that nobody is able to touch. And therefore, with that sort of impunity, God only knows what they're doing. I mean, there should be absolute. I mean, what we should be talking about here is public testimony without being behind a screen by the individual intelligence officers responsible for all these terrorist attack cover-ups or investigations. And those people should be being interrogated by MPs who are kind of, at least some of whom anyway, who have got some kind of questioning mind, but they don't get anything like that whatsoever.
No, well, you've got a situation where a kind of a series of catastrophic errors for a number of very high profile terrorist attacks that haven't been filed and should have been filed, and then you have MI5 coming out on a regular basis addressing the BBC and Sky News and saying, oh, by the way, we filed 5 or 6 major terrorist plots this year, but of course, because of operational reasons, we can't tell you who and why and how. You've just got to believe us. By the way, folks, Tony Gosling is our... Okay, let me just do this. Let me just do a quick recap on who's with us. If you're just joining the programme, Tony Gosling terrific producer and presenter, journalist. Check out thisweek.org.uk, Fridays, the politics show at BCFM, getting through a lot of things in this segment. We've got Tony to the top of the hour. Tony, on that, on MI5 saying, oh, by the way, you should be on your knees thanking us because we saved you this year from 5 terrorist attacks. Just before we talk about the European Union and the internet, go ahead. On the MI5, we just stopped a...
Okay, so there are a few that come to court. But you see, hang on a minute, they should all be coming to court. Yeah. If these people are really plotting terrorist attacks, and what we've got here is a very, very similar parallel structure with what's happened with the FBI in the United States. It's effectively what they're doing. Is they're setting people up, they're fitting people up. They go along and they're recruiting people. I mean, they've actually seemed to have some sort of army of online recruiters. And that's the way that, for example, some children, literally school children from Bethnal Green, were lured to and given money to go on a plane over to Turkey and then put on a bus down into Syria. And then they became members of ISIS. There were actually 3 or 4 of these girls were lured to do this by people on Facebook. And when they actually got down there, the guy they met was from Canadian intelligence. You know, this is a NATO intelligence operation to take school children from Bethnal Green in East London and ferry them down to ISIS. There's really very little scrutiny of this, but this is actually what's happened. I mean, I did a whole sort of investigation into that, which was published someone published it anyway, if you look it up. The thing is that people do not realise just to the extent to which the intelligence services are involved in this terror, I think, anyway. I mean, that's the conclusion I've come to over the years looking at it, and also looking at the whole background in with the Northern Ireland terror. I actually worked on for the BBC in London on covering the things like the stock exchange bomb before the IRA ceasefire, before the Good Friday Agreement, and it was quite clear that there was a sort of willingness for MI5 to actually allow these things to happen. They didn't want to stop them because they knew that it was their bread and butter. If there's a terror attack in London, this is actually quite good for us because it means that we can justify our existence.
And more money, of course. Absolutely. Now, we've got about 10 minutes left, just under 10 minutes. I want to talk about Article 13. I've gotten into this at great length with the co-founder of LiveLeak.com, Hayden Hewitt, whom this is a specialist subject for him. We're looking at the internet changing forever, but of course it's far deeper than that. We're looking at the death of journalism, maybe, if this goes ahead. It's been approved. It isn't law yet, but it's expected to become law early in 2019. Article 13. Do you want to sum it up, Tony, where you are on it and what you think it might bring?
So what's happening, it's part of a much wider move right across the Western world, and that is to change copyright from civil offences to criminal offences. That is to say, to massively up the penalties for anybody using someone else's work. Now, I mean, I use other people's work the whole time, not great paragraphs of it, but I quote people. I mean, for example, using photographs to illustrate things. And I think basically, so long as you credit the original person and they don't object, that's fine. But that's not what this is about. This is about the big news agencies like Associated Press, Press Association, people like that, simply being able to prohibit any use whatsoever of anything that they do. That means, for example, you couldn't publish it as part of an analysis of the lies that we're getting. So, you know, I mean, copyright is an important thing. It's people's livelihood. But if they don't object, I mean, for example, one of the things that should be in the new internet world is you put in, if you use say a few sentences from an official report or from an article, so long as you quote the source using if it's on the internet using a URL, then surely that's fine. I mean, what's the problem with that? What you're doing is you're actually making people more aware.
And sending them traffic, yeah, you're sending traffic. Absolutely.
And people might go and buy the book, they might go and buy the newspaper, and if necessary, they might have to log in on, if it's the other side of a paywall, and use it. This is not a problem for people, but what it does do is it is really, I think, targeting people like you and I, Richie, who what we do is we look at existing, what we're doing is we're doing a kind of jigsaw puzzle, really, looking at existing listing stories and saying, well, hang on, if you put that story together with that story, you get something pretty horrific something much more interesting. And that's what they're trying to stop, I think. And also to try and bring the police in where it used to be totally up to the, say, for example, the BBC or newspaper editors to say, well, actually, I think that's a misuse of our work. We're going to take them to the civil courts. And then, of course, the first stage in the civil court is you might wish to just take it off the internet if you think, if you agree, if you think it's fair that they're criticizing you. But, you know, it's really ramping up the opportunities to destroy publications, to destroy journalists, and destroy criticism of the rich and powerful, very much like this GDPR, so-called data protection law, does, because that doesn't have any kind of – and I was talking to some of the top lawyers in London about this at the Journalists Union Conference a few weeks ago here in the UK. I think it was up in Southport. And they said, well, there's nothing in this new law, the GDPR I'm talking about, which is already law now, which gives any kind of excuse for journalists to be criticizing rich people and powerful people. So if somebody's in a position of public trust and they are doing something wrong and you write about it, they can sue you. They can sue you for damages to their feelings. Now, this is basically what we're looking at here. Look, let me just take a step back from all this. What we're looking at here is possibly the end of the golden age of the internet. So the internet has been there as the mainstream press since the 1980s, really, in the early 90s, has completely shut down. It's become unbalanced. It's become unhinged. It's become propagandistic. It's been taken over by big vested interests. And, you know, for example, weapons of mass destruction, it's become a peddler of fake news. As that's happened, the internet has been a kind of safety valve, a stopgap where people can go, like me, for example. One of the first things I did when I finished at the BBC, or when I was, you know, told you'd go away, was to, I had quite a lot of stuff I was looking at the time, and I just thought, well, the internet's great because I can use that as my filing cabinet. I can stick all my interesting little bits and pieces on the internet, and other people might find them useful and interesting. But what they're saying effectively now is they're going to start to restrict that. So I think in the golden age of television was the 1960s and the 1970s. The golden age of the internet may be soon over, Richie.
Yeah, the implications are terrible for independent content creators. We always understood that, I mean, you summed it up perfectly. When you used material that was created by a third party, you used it by way of criticism or by way of illustrating a point, and you always credited them. And where you could, you sought permission or you dropped them a nod that you were doing it. In London, for example, when I was there in 2013 doing the TV thing, we had a very good relationship with RT and Press TV, who basically said, look, use this stuff, just make sure that we get credited for it across the board. Use what you need. If you want to take little sections of interviews, there wasn't an issue there, and I thought fair play to them. But this has terrifying implications for what we do, because if this goes to where they want it to go, this particular program couldn't be presented in the style that I presented. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I mean, I do... We do a monologue, and quite often, even when I'm speaking with a guest like yourself, I will introduce a bit of audio. I did have the audio of Dawn Waddy ready to go, but we don't need to hear it because you perfectly described what it is that she said. But you can't do that, so it's going to leave a great big hole in the programmes that we present. So I don't know what, you know, to make of it, Tony. I suppose we're just going to have to wait till early next year to see where this goes, I suppose.
Well, and also, I suppose the other thing is, it could be that in Brexit Britain, that things aren't quite so difficult, you know, as they are in Europe. I mean, the Icelandics, for example, they've said very clearly they want Iceland to be an absolute haven for free speech. So it might simply be that people like you and I, just have to base our internet sites in Iceland, and then everyone else can watch them there. But then, of course, what they'll try and do is block people from the so-called free world looking at Icelandic websites. That's the way these people's minds work. But I mean, we're in an incredible time, I think, at the moment, where there's massive things going on in the world that simply are not being reported. We had this thing last week with the Chinese social credit system, which is effectively the Chinese government saying that there are sort of 10 grades or so of of people, and anyone that criticizes the government is it will go down a grade or go down two or three grades. Anyone that is obedient and does what they're told will go up a grade. Anyone that's wealthy will go up a grade. Anyone that's poor will go down a grade. So they're actually now having a formal grading system. That's what they're talking about introducing in China, effectively a kind of government controlled caste system controlled by the Pope, who is President Xi, infallible apparently according to him. That is effectively what he's becoming, is a sort of Pope. You know, he's in there forever now, apparently. This completely unchallengeable president. But there's been very little criticism of this. Oh, gosh, no, because we want the Chinese money for our big infrastructure projects like HS2, like the Hinkley C power station. So let's not say anything nasty about China, and let's not raise the specter of them being a rather spooky totalitarian regime that is treating people like animals and saying, well, here's a high-grade person, here's a low-grade person, because they disagreed with the government. And also Turkey. Another massive shift is in Turkey, where we've seen the United States last week refuse to sell them these F-35 fighters these new aircraft from the US, which effectively means they don't trust the Turks, because they think the Turks might let the Russians have a good look at one of their fighters and find out exactly how they work. And that means that Turkey is really no longer a member of NATO, and yet there's been no reporting of this whatsoever. I mean, obviously, we've had the election over the weekend of Erdogan, re-elected. There are all sorts of questions about human rights over there, with the chairman of Amnesty International still in jail, with a lot of journalists thrown out of their jobs, a lot of newspapers which were anti-government closed down. But at the end of the day, you've got to hand it to Erdogan that even with all this clampdown, he is still managed apparently to win the vote. But he realizes he's in a region where World War III could be about to kick off, and he can't be shilly-shallying. He needs to make sure he's in control of the country, and that it's still an independent country that can choose which way it goes, rather than be controlled by one of the big superpowers.
Tony, brilliant to have you back on the show. Folks, check out The Politics Show on BCFM on Fridays. Go to thisweek.org.uk to find out more about it. Bilderberg.org as well, Tony's website, which is a treasure trove of information about the history of the Bilderberg Group. Great to have you back on, mate. Great insights into the bombing last year, and great that you were in touch with Dawn Waddy, which a lot of people, a lady whom a lot of people may have forgotten about. Very important to keep that fresh in people's minds as well. Always a pleasure to have you on. I look forward to you coming back again real soon. Cheers, Tony.
Yeah, don't rage at the mainstream press. Give Richie and I a listen. And I mean, you can easily get these podcasts and just take them in the listen in the car. Absolutely. And rather than throwing things at the television, you know, give us a listen, folks.
Legend, Tony. Thanks a lot for that. The brilliant Tony Gosling, live on the line to us there from Bristol. Thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show, Fridays on BCFM. There isn't another show like it. Check it out, top man. Right, very quick break. When we come back, some comments, and Jeffrey Jackson joins me in a few minutes. A sweltering. Did I say that earlier?